The next case is 0448, Charlene Beard, Administratrix versus Meridia Huron Hospital. Mr. Jurs.
Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time, Aaron.
May it please the court. My name is Edward Jurs, and I represent the appellant, Dr. Oscar Nicholson, in this appeal. Dr. Nicholson asks that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and reinstate the jury's verdict in his favor. The decision below should be reversed for 3 reasons. First, and most significantly, the Court of Appeals erred in holding that Dr. Nicholson's general reference to supporting professional literature was inadmissible hearsay. In doing so, the Court of Appeals erased a fine but clear distinction between the general reliance on such literature, which is permitted, and the direct quotation or admission of such literature, which is not permitted. Instead, the court advanced a vague and unworkable standard that will confound courts and litigants for years to come. The Court of Appeals decision should also be reversed because the trial court decision did not abuse its discretion in allowing Dr. Nicholson's testimony. In fact, the trial court had guidance from its own Court of Appeals in the Kane case, which allowed nearly identical testimony to be admitted. Finally, the decision below should be reversed because there was no prejudice. Dr. Nicholson's testimony would have been before the jury without the reference to supporting literature. It was corroborated in addition by 2 other expert witnesses, and even the reference to supportive literature, if phrased differently, would have been admitted without objection. The central question in this appeal is whether an expert, without violating the hearsay rule, can testify that his opinions are in part based upon and documented by professional literature. Under Evidence Rule 702, experts are permitted to rely on their education, training, and review of professional literature. That is what makes them experts. And whenever an expert relies on those things, he is essentially saying that they support his opinions. While Ohio law prohibits the admission of articles and treatises, it does not prohibit an expert from drawing upon those treatises and articles and generally indicating their support. In Petrowski versus Corey, this court held that medical articles and treatises cannot be admitted into evidence. Other courts have said since that articles cannot be identified or quoted, but none of those things happen in this case. Ohio courts have repeatedly said that experts can rely on professional literature and generally reference it. That is what happened here. In holding the testimony to be hearsay, the Court of Appeals went far beyond the Petrowski standard to establish a new and confusing standard. It ignored the interplay between Evidence Rules 702 and 802. And it ignored the fact that Dr. Nicholson was an expert. He clearly understood the medicine, and he based his opinion on his education, training, experience, and review of professional literature.
Counsel, I think the difficulty in this case is that instead of saying I generally relied on literature, he gets very specific and he says, you know, familial neutropenia can operate on safely with white blood cell count greater than 1,000. That sounds like, you know, a very specific statement that sets the definite standard of care rather than him saying the standard of care. And the reason we have that rule is, how can you attack that statement? How can you attack what that comment is when it's very specific and almost like it sounds like a direct quote from some sort of literature?
Well, if you look at the preceding testimony, he says basically the same thing as an expert. He lays out the standard, he lays out what the numbers are, and then almost as an afterthought at the end of that testimony, he says, and that's documented in the literature. Mm-hmm. Now, I think any expert is going to basically make the same statement. He's going to say, I review all of the literature. I've learned in medical school what this is about. I've studied it. I've practiced it. And these are the numbers. The way you get around your concern about hearsay, and I think that's what the red herring in this case is that you can cross-examine the expert. The key is that the person has to be qualified as an expert. Once he's qualified as an expert, he's entitled to assimilate this outside information, and the opinions are his opinions. They're not the opinions in the books. I would agree with you if the doctor said, I don't know anything about benign neutropenia, but I picked up the book on the shelf and it says that this is the standard. That might be objectionable, but that's not what happened here.
Was he testifying as a defendant or as an expert or both?
He was both the defendant and he did testify as an expert. There was a separate expert, Dr. Peitzman, who essentially gave the same opinion that this was an appropriate surgery because it was a chronic condition.
So the only objectionable part of the testimony is from the defendant who was testifying as an expert,
yes. A
second expert as well.
Right.
And didn't he say he was testifying based on his own expertise and skill? In the field
exactly.
as well?
Exactly. He said it was based on his experience, training, and education. And there was this reference to the documenting literature. But our point, and if you review his testimony, it is clear that this man understood what the medicine of this case was. They concede that there's no issue that he was an expert. They concede that he was an expert. And so the question is, was he entitled to assimilate this information and then render his opinion?
Well, counsel, if the appellant is correct in its assertions here, why is this not simply error correction of an appellate court, and not what new rule of law can this court write with regards to your case?
I think that the bright line that has been established is that you cannot quote or identify the literature, that you can generally rely upon it. They have indicated, and see, this is what's so problematic about the Court of Appeals decision, because the appellees suggest that it's okay to say that the literature supports my opinion. It's okay, clearly, to say I've read everything there is to read about this topic and I've reached this conclusion. But somehow you can't say just slightly differently, this is my opinion, this is the medicine, and it's documented in the literature. If you put side to side the Cain case, which they suggest the testimony in the Cain case in Cuyahoga County was acceptable, next to this case, they're virtually indistinguishable. The gentleman in the Cain case, the expert, was saying basically that I know that the onset of multiple sclerosis can be latent and subsequently arise, and that's documented. There are cases in literature in all languages that support that. That was okay, but in this case, Dr. Nicholson gave the medicine and says, and it's documented in the literature. That's not okay. What I'm suggesting to you is that the current line of Petrowski is a brighter line and a clearer line, and that if this line is adopted or sustained by the Court of Appeals, that the courts below are not going to understand how to distinguish these things, because they're virtually identical statements can be found on one hand to be good, okay, and on the other hand to be inadmissible. And
are you satisfied with the determinations made in Petrowski, or do you think they need to be modified?
I'm satisfied with the decision because, see, they keep citing Petrowski as supporting their position, but it doesn't, because Petrowski was a bright line saying you can't admit these things into evidence. And courts subsequently
said the book can't come in.
The book can't come
in. Because people can't understand the technical language, mm-hmm. as I understand what that
right.
case
and
stands
you
for.
You can't pick up the book in all the cases they cite. If you look,
well, there wasn't a book introduced here, was there?
No, absolutely not. There was not even a book read in this case.
So what is the clarification that this court should make between what you're arguing is acceptable law in Cain and acceptable law in Petrowski? What is the middle ground that needs to get clarified here, in your view?
I think what you should say, what this court should say, is that it is acceptable for, without quoting or reading or admitting an independent treatise, an expert can say, I've reviewed these treatises, and these treatises support my opinion, as does my training, as does my experience.
So you think that there needs to be a rule that says an expert can indicate that in addition to the expertise or skill, the person who's testifying can say, and my view is in conformity with acceptable teaching or scientific knowledge in the field?
I don't think there's a problem with that. I think because essentially that's what they do all the time. Whenever an expert gets up and says, I've been trained at Harvard Medical School, I've studied at Johns Hopkins, I've read everything there is to read on this topic, and at this point I've reached the conclusion based on all those things, it's clear that he's saying they support it.
That really is how they get to qualify themselves as an expert in some instances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a medical literature bolstering rule. a medical bolstering rule is what you're asking for.
Well, I don't know. I would limit it to medicine. I think when an expert testifies, he's basically indicating that all these things that go in that are allowed under Rule 702 and 703 for him to qualify himself as an expert, he can basically indicate that these things are I've drawn my conclusions from these sources, my training, my education, my review of literature, and they support what I'm saying.
Don't we go a little further in this case, though? There's a specific statement that's made as a statement that's pulled out in the medical literature. So it's not just, and the medical literature supports me, it's on a specific issue. Does that distinguish?
Well, I don't think it, I mean, in this particular case, he was talking about a white blood cell count level. And he gave that opinion without referring to the literature. He said, in my opinion, at the level of 1,000, you're okay. And then he said, and that's documented in the literature. So even if the court had a problem with saying it's documented in the literature, it's really harmless error. Because it was in there anyway. It was always going to be before the jury, and it's simply a question of how you phrased it. And if he had phrased it differently, if he had said, it's 1,000 is the level, and I've reviewed all the literature, I've read everything there is to read about this, and I can tell you that 1,000 is the level. Presumably, nobody would have objected to that, and that's essentially what he said, and that's what's so problematic about the Court of
Appeals.
Counsel,
what he said was, he met the standard of care. What's the basis of that opinion, doctor? The opinion is based on the fact that the medical and surgical literature states that patients who have benign familial, I have trouble with that word.
Neutropenia.
Can be operated on safely with a white blood cell counts greater than 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, the 1,000 would seem to be of critical importance here, he pegs that on the literature. Did any other expert in this case testify to the same thing using the 1,000 figures?
Yes. You're referring to his second statement, which is kind of a summation statement.
Right.
If you go back to his earlier statement, he gave the 1,000 level without reference.
Okay. That's not my question. My question is, did other experts say the literature says it's okay above 1,000?
Dr. Peitzman, who was the independent defense expert, said, number one, he didn't refer to the literature.
That's what I'm asking.
No, he did not refer.
Did anybody else refer to the literature and say the literature pegs it at 1,000?
No, he did not. He said that the levels were chronically low, and given the chronically low, this is Dr. Peitzman, these are chronically low levels, therefore the operation was appropriate. That's what Dr. Peitzman said.
But he didn't peg a threshold.
He did not peg it to the literature.
And he didn't peg a threshold number at all, did he?
He did not refer to a threshold number, no, he did not.
Would your position be different if it was in Article A, Dr. X said, and then the statement? Here we don't have an identification of any specific article whatsoever. So as far as literature being substantive evidence in violation of Petrikowski, we don't have that.
Exactly, and that's the bright line that was, you know, there was no identification, there was no reading of literature, there was no introduction of literature in this case. This was simply a general reference to supportive literature. And again, how do you draw that line if as they suggest, you can say the literature supports my views and my opinion and my conclusion, even if it's a specific conclusion, how do you distinguish that from saying it's documented in the literature? I have real trouble finding out how you can give any guidance to a court of appeals with that kind of a standard.
Counsel, at some point, on cross of the doctor, the attorney, plaintiff's attorney, could have said, well, I've got an article here that says, you know, that would have been permissible, that this is in direct contradiction to what you just stated in this article is published in this journal, et cetera, used to impeach his statement, correct?
Under certain standards, you can't impeach if it's considered a reliable journal.
Right. Well, I understand once all the foundation is set.
Right.
And I'm looking in the Court of Appeals opinion here on page 11, and Dr. Schlanger, I believe, is the expert for the plaintiff.
Right.
And does not even dispute the issue of the blood count. What he says is two procedures or two treatments that should have been looked at without his statement here on page 11 of the opinion doesn't even truly address whether 1,000 or 2.3 blood count was the standard within the medical community. What he talks about is a medication or treatment from the oncologist of either a GSF or lithium, which would have raised the blood cell count, or nutritional parameters to, again, boost and, I guess, look at what the healing potential would be. Neither of those two things were done, but that doesn't even touch upon the statements made by Dr. Nicholson here.
Which is exactly our point, is in their brief they argue that Dr. Nicholson's testimony was contradicted by Dr. Schlanger when it wasn't. All Dr. Schlanger said was he never questioned that benign neutropenia can a person be operated on with that condition. He said you should have done other tests to make sure the blood was, that the white blood cell counts that were there were viable. But he never said that he disagreed with the opinion that this was the level at which a person could be operated on generally with benign neutropenia.
Mr. Jers, isn't the legal question for us set up on page 8 of the Court of Appeals opinion, in which it says there is a distinction between reference to literature as being part of the collective basis for an expert's opinion and reference to literature as substantive evidence? Whereas the example you gave earlier, where the doctor testifies, I went to all these various schools and so forth and practiced, and I've read all the literature, and my conclusion is after reading all the literature, not just the literature that supports my opinion or my conclusion, but I would guess literature that may be contrary to that. But I've, as an expert, I've taken all that information from the literature, and I conclude that this is the standard. Here, it seems to me the Court of Appeals is saying, which sets up the legal issue for us, is saying that's not what the defendant said here when he was acting as expert. He said, There is documented, my standard is documented in the medical and surgical literature. He's singling out that literature he's read that supports his opinion versus saying, I read it all, and I conclude after reading it all that here's my opinion. It's a fine distinction, but I think there is a distinction there, is there not?
Well, I would suggest that if there is a distinction there, I think it is an extremely difficult distinction to put your hands on, and it's also one that will turn simply upon the phrasing of the testimony. Because if he had said, I've read all the literature and it goes both ways, but it documents my conclusion, then he'd be all right. So it's
right.
I don't think that you're really adding, for this case to turn on that subtlety, because it's suggesting that the decision would have been before the jury anyway. And I'd suggest you look at the Camp case where they said if you phrase it a little bit differently, it would have been before the jury. So how can you, even if you suggest that that's the bright line, how can you say that there was an abuse of discretion or that there was a prejudicial error when the courts clearly had a reasonable basis for reaching its conclusion, so there shouldn't be an abuse of discretion?
Well, isn't the dilemma here that we don't permit an expert to say, well, I read book X and testified about it. Here, he's saying, essentially, I read documented medical and surgical literature. I'm not going to tell you the name of it because I know I can't do that. But doesn't he get around our prohibition by testifying the way he did, by saying, I read there's literature that documents my opinion. I'm not going to give you the name of the book because I can't do that.
I think you're right on the crux of the case here. Every expert does that. Every expert says that my training, my education, my review of literature supports my standard of care. And you have to cross-examine every expert that's the issue. You have a battle of experts in every medical case. And they both say they were educated. They both say they review the literature. They both say essentially that those outside sources support their conclusions as experts. Then you cross-examine that expert the way you'd cross-examine any expert. And it is a battle of experts. And there are people that will say those things support them on each side. And then the jury decides that. But I don't think that you can say that it was inappropriate in this case, because I think that's essentially, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to draw the distinctions that they're trying to draw. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Durst. Mr. Robinault.
Thank you. May it please this honorable court, I represent the Charlene Baird, the administrator of the estate of Ralph Moss in this matter. And I think it's important to note that this physician, defendant physician, who's also testifying as an expert witness at this trial, used a specific reference to literature to support his opinion that he complied with the standard of care. And that was the central issue in this case. The central issue is, was there a deviation from the standard of care? So the defendant physician gets up on the stand and says, specifically, I met the standard of care. It's my opinion that I met the standard of care, and it was reasonable to take him to surgery with a white blood cell count of 2,300 and no differential on December 12, 2000. And then what's the basis for that opinion? The basis, that opinion is based upon the fact that medical and surgical literature states that a patient who gave benign familial, patients who have benign familial neutropenia can be operated on safely with a white blood cell count greater than 1,000. That is as specific as it gets.
Did your counsel expert contest that at all?
I think the expert did not contest this particular, our expert did not contest that particular statement because this was I think a defense that evolved at trial. But I think even more.
But the rule 706 would say that you could have used any scientific or article for impeachment purposes, could you not? Had you chosen to do so?
You're correct, Your Honor. There's no question that had we known specifically what article he was referring to, we would have been able to cross-examine him effectively. But I think that issue, whether or not—
Well, the trial court said you could ask him that.
The trial court said we could ask him—
There was an objection made to the testimony, and then in the court's ruling, the trial court said— part of the objection was, we don't even know what he's referring to, so we can't even form a question. And he said, well, ask him which article he's referring to.
Well,
he wasn't pressed on that issue.
I think that comment at sidebar was directed to the defense lawyer. Ask him what he relied on. And then the next question was to the physician at trial by the defense lawyer was, What did you rely on? And he again referenced, that's when he made a reference to the general body of literature. So in this particular case, I think it's even more prejudicial that we don't have a specific citation upon which to cross-examine this expert. We don't know anything about.
You think he should have been able to reference a specific text and author?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
That's in direct examination.
I thought you said you were more prejudiced by this vague reference as opposed to a specific reference.
Well, I think that's therein lies the problem between the Ohio rules and the federal rules. In the federal court, there can be a specific reference to an article. So there's in a situation like this, when a physician or an expert says, here's the body of medicine or here's the article and here's the specific medical principle that I'm relying on, then they can be cross-examined effectively by the opposing counsel.
Counsel, was the doctor asked, all right, doctor, now what is this literature you're referring to? Was that asked on cross-examination?
I don't think it was. I don't have a specific recollection of whether that question was asked.
But it could have been on cross-examination.
It certainly could have been.
Okay.
The issue of whether or not, I think it's important in this appeal, is the issue of whether or not this was prejudicial. The Court of Appeals, in their opinion, found that this testimony was prejudicial based upon their review of the evidence before them. That specific issue has not been appealed.
But they're talking about hearsay. They're talking about the fact that part of the concern about hearsay is you can't cross-examine. Here you had a live doctor on the stand testifying his opinion and bolstering his testimony by saying, plus the literature agrees with me on this issue. You could have cross-examined on, all right, doctor, we understand this and this. Where is that literature? What are you referring to? What articles? Where are they published? Who wrote them? And none of those questions were asked, were they?
I don't think they were, Your Honor, because the questions that were asked of this witness after a sidebar occurred was, what articles are you referring to? That was asked of him by his attorney in direct examination, and he couldn't answer the question. So it was apparent that he didn't have any specific citation that he was referring to.
Well, so, counsel, doesn't that generally point then, or directly point to the fact that this was a general accumulation of information on this particular subject that this defendant had gleaned over his years of practice and experience? If he's not naming an article by the such and such clinic published in this year and this study group, it tends to make it more in the realm of generalized information on this particular issue, which is the white blood count. One of the things that I want to ask you that I brought up with opposing counsel is the quality of the testimony of the plaintiff's expert here in not discrediting this opinion, this expert opinion put forth by the defense as to the legitimate standard for the operation on the decedent with the blood count of 2.3 or 2,300, however you want to term it. I don't see anything in the opinion that is put forth by the plaintiffs that would discredit this opinion.
Well,
this expert opinion.
I think the key point on that is that Dr. Schlanger was called before this testimony was elicited on direct examination. Dr. Schlanger was called in the plaintiff's case in chief, and this direct examination of this physician was called in the defendant's case,
Isn't there a deposition, a discovery process that takes place before you get to trial?
Absolutely there is.
And was this...
Both
they were deposed.
Everybody was deposed. And this whole issue of benign familial neutropenia is not anywhere in the medical record. And it's something that a defense that evolved at trial. For this doctor to say that I met the standard of care by taking this patient with a 2,300 white blood cell count, and then specifically point to literature that says, hey, you can take a patient with this benign familial neutropenia to surgery with a blood count, white blood cell count as low as 1,000, and that's what the literature states. Well, the jury's going to naturally conclude that, boy, if it was 2,300, that's well above 1,000, and it was appropriate.
But are you saying you were surprised by this testimony?
Well, I think that this whole...
Could you not have brought your doctor back on redirect or asked for a recess and said, this is something new, it didn't come out in discovery, we need to refute this? I mean, the defense sort of leads us to believe that the issue of people with normally low blood count can be operated on is not the issue. It's, you know, the specific patient and what was done and not done. What was the exact theory you were using that you couldn't have gone into rebuttal mode?
Well, in terms of the testimony in this case, we would have been in a position of unringing the bell at this point, as is referenced by the court in another case. This testimony and his opinion being supported by a specific reference to something in the medical literature is so prejudicial that we'd be in a position of unringing the bell.
That's what cross-examination does. It unrings the bell. That's
well,
the
purpose
of it.
There's no question, I think we also have to recognize that the Court of Appeals, in this case, found that the admission of this testimony was prejudicial. And that particular issue was not brought before this court in an assignment of error. That finding by the Court of Appeals was not appealed. And so I think we have to take it on face, at the Court of Appeals' opinion at face value. This was prejudicial.
Counsel, back to the pretrial discovery. The defendant doctor's deposition was taken.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He had not, prior to surgery, diagnosed There's nothing in his medical records or his deposition testimony indicating the diagnosis of the persistent low blood count of this patient?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, at the time of discovery, the explanation of why surgery was acceptable with this low blood count was not tendered in his deposition testimony at all.
There is nothing about, in his deposition testimony about this patient having benign familial neutropenia.
And nothing in the hospital records or
in the
doctor's records?
Nothing in the hospital record from this surgery. I think it was a defense that evolved when the defense lawyer subpoenaed records from all the other providers throughout this patient's life, and he found some white blood cell counts that were slightly below the normal range. And that's how that defense evolved. But when it comes to
after the patient is dead, the doctor decides it was okay to proceed to operate with an exceedingly low blood count
because
of something unknown to the doctor at the time the doctor did the surgery.
That's correct, Your Honor. For the defendant physician to come in and say, I met the standard of care, I took him to surgery with this 2,300 white blood cell count, and it's okay because the literature says you can do it. You can take a person to surgery with a count as low as 1,000 is extremely prejudicial. The jury, which hears this evidence, thinks to themselves, well, if there's a body of literature out there that says you can take a patient with a level as low as 1,000, this guy must have done the appropriate thing.
So the plaintiff did not raise the blood count issue?
The defense expert said you cannot take a patient. Dr. Schlanger testified unequivocally that you cannot take a patient who's had chemotherapy recently to surgery with a blood count level this low, and there are the GSF and the lithium treatments that you can use to raise the blood count level. And he specifically said that when you take someone to surgery with a low white blood cell count level like this, you run the risk of the person getting an extensive infection, which is exactly the cause of Mr. Moss's death. He died from an overwhelming blood infection, sepsis.
Counsel, could you again state the issue that is not here on appeal in your view?
Well, in my view, the only issue that was brought before this court was whether the use and the testimony of Dr. Nicholson on the specific issue of whether he, on the specific quotation that he met the accepted standard of care and that the medical and surgical literature states that a patient who has benign familial neutropenia can be operated on safely with a white blood cell count.
Okay, but you've a couple times said as to something else, that issue was not appealed. I'm having a hard time understanding what the issue is that wasn't appealed.
The only assignment of error that was appealed was whether or not it was appropriate for the physician to
I understand that, but what is it you're saying isn't here?
What I'm saying is that the Court of Appeals specifically found that the admission of this testimony was prejudicial. That was their conclusion based upon their review of the record.
Isn't that in any case we have to look at, okay, if there was an error, then did it affect the outcome of the trial? Because if it didn't, it's not reversible error. That's inherent in any appeal. You don't have to allege that.
I think if you're asserting, if the appellant is bringing that issue before the court, there should be a separate assignment of error that says the Court of Appeals opinion is inaccurate and there was no prejudicial effect, even had it been admitted.
I think that's inherent in our analysis, isn't it?
Mr. Obanoff, are you familiar with the Edwards versus Radecki case?
I am, Your Honor.
Can you distinguish that for me from this case? It's a Sixth Circuit, it's a Sixth District case, I appreciate, but it seems as though similar circumstance with a different result.
Yes, I think that in that particular case, the jury found that a surgeon was not negligent.
Yes, right.
And in that case, the physician was permitted to testify that certain medical literature supported the use of a transverse loop colostomy.
Right, right.
And the court in that case said it was, and I think the reason it's distinguishable is that the court concluded that the appellant was correct in maintaining that the appellee's testimony on this matter was inadmissible hearsay, for which there was no cognizable exception under the hearsay rule. So in that particular case, the court found that there was inadmissible hearsay. And in that particular case, the court found, though, it wasn't prejudicial because the door had been opened. So had been opened by a question of the appellant, of the defense doctor, that he asked a question, is there any medical literature that supports your testimony? And so that's why I think that's distinguishable. I think the Edwards case actually supports an affirmation of the Court of Appeals decision in this case. And with that, I see my time is concluded. I think on behalf of Charlene Beard, I specifically request that that this court affirm the opinion of the Court of Appeals and reverse this matter to the trial court for another trial.
Thank you, Mr. Rubinoff. Mr. Jurst, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. Very briefly, our second proposition of law goes into the prejudice question. We say there was no prejudice here because the doctor's testimony would have been before the jury anyway. And to the justice's point, their expert never challenged this basic proposition that you can that a person with this condition can be operated on at these levels. He raised an entirely different question, which was before the jury, which was whether or not you rechecked the white blood cell counts that were there and did additional checking. He never criticized this. I was not the trial counsel, but I find it extremely hard to believe that they did not go into this in his deposition and Dr. Peitzman's deposition, because Dr. Peitzman said that these were chronically low conditions, therefore it was acceptable to go forward and you met the standard of care. And as you pointed out, Justice, if you were surprised at trial, you certainly could have brought him back on rebuttal, and I find it very hard to believe that this wasn't covered in deposition by either Dr. Peitzman or Dr. Nicholson. Thank you, Your Honor. I ask that you reverse and reinstate.
Well, counsel, did your doctor raise this issue, this condition, in his deposition?
I cannot speak to the depositions, but I will say that if you look at his testimony, he indicates that this is something that he encounters in his practice all the time. So I think it's very
not his testimony. His testimony comes after the plaintiff's experts have testified.
I understand, and I don't know the answer to the question.
In preparing was the plaintiff's expert there live, or was it by deposition?
I was not trial counsel. I believe he was there live.
Okay. But he's gone when your doctor testifies he testified.
But, Your Honor, it was not only Dr. Nicholson, it was also Dr. Peitzman, who's a separate independent defense expert that they were entitled to depose, who gave a comparable opinion about the chronically low white blood cell count. They had to be on notice with Dr. Peitzman's testimony that this was going to be part of the defense. And if you read Dr. Nicholson's testimony, he indicates this is not something he invented after the death, but it's something that he encountered frequently in his practice and understood that with African-American patients that there is 30% of the population has this chronic condition. It's clear from his testimony that he understood that as a practitioner, and it was not something he pulled out of a book at the end. I mean, that's our whole point.
Thank you, Mr. Jurst. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.